Welcome to The Road to Now. I'm Ben Sawyer. Today we're bringing you an episode about the economy. There's been a lot of discussion about the tax cuts and its relationship to employment and the overall economy at large. And so we wanted to give a couple of episodes attention to this factor and what history can teach us about it. So in our first of these two episodes, we invited Robert McIlvaine, who is a professor of history at Millsaps College and one of the country's foremost experts on the Great Depression. We got in touch with him because he recently published an article in the Washington Post, an op-ed that was entitled, "I'm a Depression Historian, and the GOP tax bill is straight out of 1929. He published this op-ed back in November, and we wanted to talk to him about it because it was a really great application of the past to the present. And so we finally caught up with him, and we recorded this episode a few weeks ago. Now, it is fascinating. We talk about the relationship between tax policy and the Great Depression, what we can learn now, kind of what have we learned in the past about the way tax breaks relate to the economy. And honestly, as you guys know, this is the stuff that's right up my alley. I love this conversation. Now, when we got through with it, Bob and I were talking, and we felt like, even though this is a really smart conversation, it definitely leaned towards more towards the left or more towards what people would say would be the Democratic perspective on things. So as a part of our goal to make sure that our audience is informed and not simply given one very strong perspective on an issue, we decided that we were going to do a second episode on this with Brian Riedel, who has a more conservative perspective on the economy. So today's episode is one of two episodes that will be airing back to back. The next one will be next Monday and will feature Brian Riedel. Now, you may be noticing at this point that Bob Crawford is not here with me for the intro. Don't worry, he was there with me for the interview. But the reason Bob is not recording this intro with me is a good reason. Bob and his family are on their way back from St. Jude, where Hallie just had a clear scan, 5 years clear now, and we couldn't be happier. So thank you so much for all the kind words, the thoughts, the prayers you've sent towards the Crawford family, and Godspeed to Bob and Melanie, who should be arriving home about the time this episode airs. Thank you.
Ramsar Records' David Childers reteams with producer Don Dixon for Run Skeleton Run. The lauded North Carolina singer-songwriter's latest effort features vocals and banjo contributions by Scott Avett of the Avett Brothers. Road to Now listeners can even get a 20% off discount on David Childers' new album by using the promo code HISTORY at RamsarRecords.com.
Dr. Robert McIlvaine, welcome to the Road to Now.
Glad to be with you.
I want to start off because you recently wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post. The op-ed was entitled, "I'm a Depression Historian. The GOP tax bill is straight out of 1929. That is a provocative title, and I think more people are aware of the recent tax plan. Could you start off by telling us about the 1920s, the tax plan that you're speaking of, and the similarities between then and now?
Yes, well, of course, newspapers like to put on provocative headlines, and straight out of 1929 is accurate in one sense, but misleading in another. That is that the tax plan itself is not from 1929. Rather, 1929 is in significant part a consequence of the tax cuts under the Coolidge administration in the 1920s, particularly the Revenue Act of 1926. During the 20s, the entire government was under control of the Republican Party as it is now, and it was following the same sort of basic philosophy as the Republican Party has followed economic philosophy, at least since the late 19th century, which came to be called trickle-down economics. It has never worked, but they believe in it as a religion, basically, that the free market is God and must be worshipped. And Andrew Mellon, one of the richest men in the world, who was Treasury Secretary under Harding, Coolidge, and most of Hoover's administration, was basically in charge of the tax policy. And the 1926 Revenue Act greatly reduced taxes on the richest levels, the top marginal tax rates. In fact, progressive Republican Senator George Norris of Nebraska said when this bill was being discussed in Congress that Mr. Mellon would get a larger personal reduction in taxes than the aggregate of virtually all of his constituents in Nebraska. and that was true, and it's the same sort of thing that the tax bill that was signed into law just before Christmas by President Trump is doing. So I can go into more detail on a lot of that stuff, but I don't like to just keep babbling on forever.
Well, we actually appreciate babbling on here, so this is a babble-on free zone. I read a book a few years ago about Calvin Coolidge, and it was by Amity Shales, I believe. And I recall that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but he sat down with his maybe budget director once every other month, and they just cut. And they would just get together every few months and cut the budget. Can you talk about Coolidge and maybe how he differed, if at all, from Harding and then Hoover to come after him as far as taxes and budgetary expenditures went?
Yeah, well, Coolidge, I guess we could start with Harding, and Harding didn't have any particular philosophy at all other than to have poker parties and bring in whiskey during Prohibition. But Coolidge basically believed in the idea that government should do as little as possible and set out to do that. He famously or infamously said, the business of America is business. He wanted to turn business loose, have as little regulation as possible, as little taxation, and just let the free market determine what happened. Believing, although I don't think on any real philosophical level in his case, that this was going to automatically work for the common good. So he was quite susceptible to what someone like Mellon, who he would respect as a man who had made so much money and knew what was going on in the economy, what he wanted to do. And so when Mellon wanted to cut taxes, he was very willing to go along with that. You refer to Amity Shales, and I have not read her book on Coolidge. I did read her book on the Great Depression itself, and from my perspective, it is absolutely wrong in almost everything. It's trying to make the argument that it was overregulation and government interference that caused the Depression, and for one thing, that just doesn't quite work chronologically. She's referring to things that happened in the 1930s is what caused the Depression, basically saying that, well, yes, there was an economic downturn in 1929, but it would have righted itself if the government had just not done anything.
Yeah, and I hate to interrupt, but let me just say this for our audience. There is no doubt, I think, in anyone's mind that all her work comes from a certain presupposition. And she's, I would say, a conservative historian. I read her book, The Forgotten Man, and it was basically she tried to expose the fraud of the New Deal, was basically what she was out to do with that book.
That's the book to which I'm referring, and I wrote an extensive and scathing review of it at the time it came out. What she was doing is sort of the crowning, bringing together of the arguments that people in the Republican Party and conservative economic people have been trying to make since the late 1970s. Totally free market economics had been discredited by the Great Depression and was not a very respectable position to take. And in order to bring it back, as some people were trying to do by the end of the 1970s, they had to come up with some way to explain why it was not the cause of the collapse in 1929 and subsequently. And this had begun to be done by others, but she sort of brought all that together in her book, The Forgotten Man.
So you say that the tax plan of the 1920s greatly contributes to the Great Depression, which followed in the years just after it. What particular elements do you see in that tax plan of the 1920s that lead to the bubble and the bust?
Yeah, I'm not saying that it was just the tax plan itself, but rather the tax plan is a prime example of the overall idea, which basically, again, is trickle-down economics. The idea is to make the people at the top richer, and eventually that prosperity will trickle through on those below. William Jennings Bryan had famously said in his Cross of Gold speech in 1896 that there are two different philosophies of government, And the one is that if you just legislate to, paraphrasing, of course, if you just legislate to make the richer even richer, their prosperity will leak through on those below. And he argued that the Democratic view, and it hasn't always been, but generally it has been, if you work to try to make the masses prosperous, then everyone else is sort of rising on them as they go up. And so these have been two fundamentally different approaches for well over a century now. And during the 1920s, the Republican view of this was put into full effect, and quite simply, it didn't work. I think one of the more significant things in kind of testing out how this works is if you look at the concentration of income at the very top, and you can take the top 1%, the top 0.1%, or particularly interestingly, the top 0.01% that in the period since World War One, the two times it peaked with 0.01% getting almost 8% of the total income were in 1928 and 2007. Now, that's not a real large sample to go on, but the fact that in both cases the economy collapsed the next year certainly is suggestive of the idea that concentrating wealth and income at the very top does not trickle down to everyone else and doesn't work. And one of the things I think is important to understand about that is that probably, although we have no statistics, at least none that I would be aware of that would seem to be reliable on how much wealth and income may have been concentrated in the among the very rich in earlier centuries, it might well be that if you go back to the Middle Ages and people living in castles may have had even more of the wealth, a greater percentage than what we're talking about here in the 20th and 21st centuries. That may have been objectionable in a moral sense, and I think it was, but the difference is that by the time we get to the 1920s, we're in an economy that's based on mass production, and so that in turn requires mass consumption. And as Barack Obama said and was widely criticized from the right for saying during, I think it was in the campaign in 2008, we need to spread the money around a little bit. Again, you can argue that morally, but it's also necessary when you are operating in an economy that's dependent on mass consumption. The masses of people have to have enough of the income to consume the stuff that's being produced. And that was clearly the case by the 1920s. New products, automobiles weren't entirely new, but in vastly larger numbers. Radio was entirely new. All sorts of kitchen appliances were new. And these things are coming off assembly lines. The people who were the super rich might be able to afford to buy 50 automobiles a year, but they weren't going to do it.
Right.
They might buy five or six to show off. But so this gets to be a clear economic problem as well as a moral problem. And too much of it is concentrating at the top, just doesn't work. And we've seen that over and over again. But the thing is that, let me bring it up this way. Franklin Roosevelt famously said during the 1932 campaign, take a method and try it. If it doesn't work, throw it out and try something else. But above all, try something, an experimental method where you see whether something works. Well, the Republicans, as far as I know, never quite put it in those terms, but essentially their policy then and now is take the method because they believe ideologically there is only one way to go. If it doesn't work, try it again. If it doesn't work, try it again. If it doesn't work, try it again. But above all, keep on trying the same thing. And that's the difference between a pragmatic approach and a stiffly ideological approach.
When you talk about try it again and try it again and try it again, I think about Paul Ryan and how he comes out of the lineage of Jack Kemp. Kemp is his idol. And Kemp was one of these trickle-down gurus during the—he was in the Senate, but he really was a promoter of trickle-down economics during the Reagan administration. Can you talk about how we got from Kemp and the way it worked in the 80s to Paul Ryan? Why would somebody like Paul Ryan look at Kemp's philosophy and say— Well, we need to try it again. I mean, is there anything to it that would make him believe that it would work at some point?
Well, first of all, it's important that you bring up the Reagan years in the 80s and the very clear connection in terms of policy between the Reagan years and the Coolidge Mellon years. Reagan actually talked about how Coolidge cut taxes three times in the 1920s, and we have the greatest growth and prosperity the country has ever enjoyed. He seemed to, I don't think he's quite like Trump and would have been totally unaware of the fact the Great Depression occurred, since after all he lived through it. But he seemed to be just ignoring the fact that after a few years of the economy booming, it all collapsed. And so he wanted to do the same thing again. Jack Kemp and others were pushing this idea of supply-side economics. And the basic idea of supply-side economics is the same trickle-down approach. You do what you can to increase production, increase the wealth of the people at the top, and then somehow, well, it goes back to Say's law, which is supply creates its own demand. And in one sense, the most simple sense, I guess that's true. If you create something, then something of value has been created. But the problem is, if you create a supply of stuff, and people might, it might even be things that people want, but if they don't have the money to buy it, it doesn't work. And that has always been the problem in this. So what Reagan was doing in passing his massive tax cuts, you have to get below the surface a little bit more, which perhaps we can do in a minute. But one thing was the idea that this was going to create a new wave of prosperity. And the only way it was doing that, and he insisted that it was going to pay for itself, as Republicans are talking about these days, that the economy would grow so much that tax revenues at lower rates would bring in more. During the 1980 campaign, when he talked about drastically cutting tax rates, increasing military spending, and maintaining the social safety net, when you're starting out with a deficit to begin with, and this is going to result in a balanced budget, a couple of his opponents had interesting ways of describing that. George Bush called it voodoo economics, and John Anderson, when he was asked how John Anderson, a Republican congressman who sought the Republican nomination and then ran as independent in 1980, said the only way you can do that is with smoke and mirrors. I remember at the time I wrote an article suggesting that the only way to do it was to propose a constitutional amendment repealing arithmetic, but which again might be what the Republicans need to do now. But the thing is that after a really serious economic downturn at the beginning of the Reagan years, the economy did start to improve. In fact, in 1984, he was running on America's back, and I wrote another article at that point saying, yes, America is back, and if you look at most of the indicators, it is back to where it was in 1980 when Reagan was talking about the failed policies of the past. It's just that things had gotten so much worse in between that it was now on an upward trajectory, but was only back to where it had been in 1980. But the fact was that the reason things were getting better then had nothing to do with this magic of supply-side economics. It was straightforward Keynesian economics that had created such a deficit. I remember, I guess it was a little bit after the 84 election, I was working on a book and interviewing Senator Lloyd Benson of Texas, who would later be Michael Dukakis' running mate in 1988. And he said, well, you can't help but create some stimulus when you're writing $200 billion of hot checks every year. And basically that was it. You know, it was stimulus. It was using budget deficits to create this boom, but it wasn't supply-side economics. Oh, and now as far as Ryan is concerned, Ryan, I'm sure, greatly admired what Jack Kemp was proposing, but Ryan's real god, interestingly enough, as a self-professed Catholic, was Ayn Rand, an atheist, and Ryan's dream, apparently since he was a teenager, has been to totally destroy the social welfare state. Let everybody sink or swim on their own basis. He is someone, again, who fancies himself as a great Christian. I think he must have...
He thinks he's Catholic.
Yeah. See, when he read the Sermon on the Mount, I think he must have been holding it up to a mirror and reading it backwards. But there's nothing Christian about it at all. And he's just really eager. I mean, I never saw him so happy as when this tax bill was passed, because it's transferring more money to the rich. He hopes that it will, and indeed a lot of the people around Reagan hoped that the big tax cuts then would force a great contraction of the welfare state, because they could just argue there wasn't enough money. And Ryan has made it very clear that he wants to move against Medicare and Medicaid and even Social Security and try to remove that whole welfare state and let people, as they like to say, pull themselves up by their bootstraps, which is an interesting image. You know, everybody always talks about pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I realized some years ago that really wouldn't work, and so I now, once a year in a class, have a student who either already has boots on, usually a woman, or I bring in a pair of boots that have straps on them and say, here, put this on and let me see you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And you quickly realize it's a physical impossibility, which somehow seems significant. The thing is, Republicans, going back as far as 1968, have run as the anti-60s party. They wanted to repeal the 60s in a cultural and behavioral way, but also in terms of the sort of programs of the Great Society, and return to the good old days before the 1960s. In other words, both an anti-60s party and an anti-60s party before the 60s. And that's exactly what Trump was campaigning on when he said, make America great again. He was bringing up this image of America in the 1950s and the good old days when white men were still in charge, and not realizing the top marginal tax rate was 90% under Eisenhower. But the thing is that there's a lot of nostalgia for life in the 1950s, almost all of it coming from people watching the old black and white sitcoms, which didn't portray life accurately even then. But what is often forgotten is that life was not so great in the 1950s. If you happen to have more pigmentation in your skin than the average American, or you happen to have a second X chromosome. But from the perspective of Trump and a lot of his white male followers, that's not a problem. That's a plus for going back to the 1950s.
I think Paul Ryan is a man of contradictions, because he's a big fan of Ayn Rand. And then in 2008, when asked what his favorite band was, he said Rage Against the Machine, which that is a combination that is very interesting. But to go on I would agree with this, because I'm very interested in the economy. I study the history of capitalism. There's just no evidence that cutting taxes for wealthier people improves the average working person's life. The cases in which it's happened are not particularly good. And as you said, it's this interesting fact that sometimes people just straight up will say, no, that's not true, that the highest marginal tax rate in the United States between 1946 and 1963, i.e. the years a lot of people think were the years when America was great, the highest marginal tax rate is 90%, and sometimes a bit above that. So my question for you is this, and what do you think about it, about this question? Because I'm always wondering, why, in spite of the absolute lack of evidence, and as you say, we've tried this, and it has not done what it says it's going to do, why do you think that so many people still buy into this? Why do people so many people believe this, when not only is there not evidence, but generally the tax relief that comes and the extra wealth ends up going significantly to people who aren't the folks who support it? Why do you think that they continue to believe this?
Well, at the moment, the substantial majority of people apparently aren't believing it, but the hope of the Republicans in passing it is that when they start to see a small amount, a larger amount in their paychecks or less being taken out in withholding, that they will then see that this is helping them. The idea has been, and this was very clear with the Reagan tax cuts, the idea of the Trojan horse that the lowering of the rates overall was simply a way to get the cutting of the top rates approved by people who would be happy that they were getting something too. But it was entirely clear that the goal was to cut the top tax rates and make the rich richer. So the idea of why some people go along with that is, I don't really care how much benefit the people at the top get. That's neither here nor there to me. As long as I'm getting some benefit, I'm for it. A lot of people also, I think, fall into the rhetoric or the arguments that are being made by people that are being made so forcefully that these people are going to get richer or are job creators, and you need to make them richer so they will invest and that will create jobs. Of course, we have seen very clearly that meeting of, I guess, with CEOs that occurred a few weeks before the tax bill was passed, and asking how many of them planned to use the windfall that they would get to invest and create new jobs, and hardly anybody raised their hand. But I think people in the public, especially if they're in bad shape and desperate for something, tend to grab at whatever straw is there, and people who are making a really forceful argument that this is going to work, they put their faith in that, at least for a while.
You say in your op-ed, you had a really interesting line here where you talked about some of the particular issues, and you said you singled out the inheritance tax, and you say that the inheritance tax, and you were commenting on the original plan. This was not the plan that was eventually worked out, but you say that taking away the inheritance tax would, quote, reverse an important aspect of the American Revolution. Could you explain what you mean by this?
Right. Well, let me get into that by pointing out a few other things in terms of how far back the current Republicans are trying to go. Pointing out that clearly the Trump campaign, and indeed for a long time before that, was to repeal the 1960s, go back to the imagined good old days of the 1950s. Paul Ryan and others who want to totally overturn the welfare state are now gleefully hoping to go back even farther than that, to the 1920s, repeal the New Deal social programs as well. Go back not just to the 1920s, but ideally to go back to the 1890s, the age of the robber barons then, the first Gilded Age. We're really in a second one now. But if they actually succeeded in totally repealing the inheritance tax, that might take us back to the Middle Ages when we saw an hereditary aristocracy. Something that was one of the things the American Revolution was fighting against, established in the United States, because the Republicans cleverly dubbed this the death tax. And we're all familiar with the saying that only two things in life were certain, death and taxes, but what is not pointed out is that those are mutually exclusive. The dead pay no taxes. They're not taxes on the dead. They're taxes on their often ne'er-do-well heirs. I suggested some time ago as a counter to the death tax that it ought to be called the Paris Hilton tax. now we might call it the Ivanka, Don Jr., and Eric tax. It's a tax on people who, you know, most of these people argue that accumulating wealth is a sign that we live in a meritocracy and people become rich because they do good things that help other people. Well, people who get their wealth, what is really the old-fashioned way they inherited it, didn't do anything to deserve it other than choose rich parents. And it totally undermines the idea that we have a meritocracy and nobody gets a big advantage over others at the starting line. And if almost all of this goes to 0.2%, 99.8% of estates don't pay any federal inheritance tax even before the expansion of the rise in the limit that was passed in this bill. And so it's a tiny percentage of people, but they are so rich that the result of not taxing any of that would be a massive loss to the federal treasury and generally to the public good, for the only purpose of creating a passing down of wealth in families and what amounts to an hereditary aristocracy.
So we've kind of established here that we've tried this many times in the past, trickle down. It's something that just keeps coming back again and again. It's part of the Republican conservative religious doctrine, if you will. That on the other side, you have like Bernie Sanders. You have the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which probably would say it comes from Roosevelt's New Deal, or as we've learned from our friend Jefferson Cowie, the period maybe now known as the Great Exception. What are the possible downsides of an extreme progressive agenda?
Well, I being in favor of a fairly extreme progressive agenda, I'm not someone who would point out particular downsides. But the fact is that I referred earlier to the graphs of the concentration of income and how they peaked just before the crash of 1929 and the collapse of 2008. The period in between, when there was much less of an extreme maldistribution of income during World War II and the middle decades of the 20th century, was a time of much more widely shared prosperity. Things generally worked. Also during that period, there were strong labor unions. There was government regulation of some of the biggest excesses of a totally unregulated free market. And, of course, there were other things that were happening around the world. The position of the United States is totally dominant in the world coming out of World War II and potential competitors being on their backs for a long time. All of that certainly played a part in it. But at the very least, having high top marginal tax rates, strong labor unions, and government regulation didn't prevent this emergence of the most prosperous middle class that the world has ever seen.
But I guess the question I really wanted to ask was, is there a happy medium? Are there cycles in the life of a nation or in the economic life of a nation where it's good to cut taxes for a period? It's healthy, and then you get to that point where it becomes unhealthy, and then you raise them for 10, 20 years, and then you cut them. Is there some in-between here that is kind of the sweet spot?
Well, sure. In terms of what Keynes argued, you use taxation as well as some other policies in order to deal not only with economic downturns, but also with the economy becoming overheated. In those cases, you would raise taxes and try to calm the economy down so it didn't get out of hand and cause a collapse. The problem with that has always been that it's much easier to cut taxes than to raise taxes, and so it doesn't seem to work in that way. The way I would see the happy medium, I came up with this a couple of years ago, Winston Churchill said, I believe it was in 1946, and I think he was quoting someone else, but he said that it has been said that democracy is the worst of all possible political systems, except for every other political system anyone has ever come up with. And I think that the American founders understood something like that, although they didn't put it in those words. They believed that democracy was the worst of all possible political systems, but that any other would be worse. But the democracy carries with it all sorts of dangers, of excesses, of precisely the sort of things we've just seen over the last year or so. And so they set up a system that was based on democracy, but with checks and balances to try to rein in the possible ill consequences from it. Well, I think the same idea should be applied to economic systems, that capitalism is the worst of all possible economic systems, except for every other economic system anybody's ever thought of. And so we need a basically capitalist system, but we need to understand that there are tendencies within that capitalist system for things to get really out of hand, for some people to become fabulously rich, for other people to be suffering greatly, tendencies for the economy to go into a boom and bust cycle and so forth. And so you need a basically capitalist system, but you need checks and balances, you need regulations. It seems to me just to be common sense. Then we can get to arguing over which specific regulations, how much regulation, but you can't just totally turn the free market loose. It makes no sense. It's the analogy, if we are going to just let nature take its course, well, then we wouldn't do anything like build levees in New Orleans or something. You know, we just let it wash away whenever it's going to wash away. People have enough intelligence to try to deal with some of these problems that are inherent in a free market system. Again, I believe we need a basically free market system, but we need to regulate it for the common good.
So in the summer of 2007, you looked at the economy and you looked at several factors, and you were one of the few people in 2007 who predicted a collapse was coming. Nobody else could really see it. People were in disbelief. The economy had been looking great for so long. You studied the Great Depression in the 1920s. How did studying that era allow you to see what was coming in 2007?
Well, I don't think it requires any clairvoyance. It is just a matter of kind of looking at the evidence, and the evidence from the 20s, but not just from the 20s, suggests that whenever this idea of supply-side economics trickle down, reduce regulations, cut taxes on the rich is implemented, that sometimes it provides some stimulus for a short period of time, but it leads ultimately to disaster. It simply doesn't work. And incidentally, I had also predicted the collapse in 1987. In fact, had suggested in a book that I that came out earlier in 1987 that if you compared where things were year by year or month by month in the 1920s, that the point that would be parallel to October of 1929 would be October of 1987.
Wow.
And that was kind of just luck. I mean, that it was going to be around that time that something bad was going to happen, I was pretty confident, but as far as getting that precise, it was just a lucky coincidence, I guess. But I don't think, and if you look at the 2000s and what the deregulation, which was not entirely done under W, it was some of that was done late in the Bill Clinton years, but this was just stupid. I mean, you know, repeal of some of the New Deal legislation was just absurd. And then saying you can't regulate these various exotic financial instruments that were being traded around and you can do anything you want with them. And the housing bubble, I don't understand how anybody couldn't see that was a bubble that has to burst. You go to these places where houses cost just vastly more than the big majority of the people in the area had to pay for them, that it was just going to have to collapse at some point. So, again, I don't think it was that difficult to see, but oftentimes people don't see what is fairly obvious because they don't want to see it.
Yes, the irrational exuberance, right? I was actually reading. I was reading Galbraith's History of the Great Crash in graduate school at the end of 2008, January 2009, and as I was reading it, he has so many wonderful stories there. You know about Ponzi schemes, and his advice is you don't look for Ponzi schemes when things go bad; they'll pop up. The time to look for Ponzi schemes is when everything looks like it's going great. And like as I'm reading that, the Bernie Madoff thing comes on TV. It was insane.
It's attributed to Mark Twain, although nobody has ever been able to find that he actually said it, but history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes, and that seems to clearly be the case when you follow the same sort of economic policies that have been shown time and time again not to work. And one other example that I think is really important in this regard in the other direction is when Bill Clinton proposed a quite modest increase in the top marginal tax rate from 36% to 39.6% in his 1993 budget. Every conservative, totally free market, classical economics person denounced it and said it would lead to collapse. Every single Republican in both houses of Congress voted against it, and instead it was followed by one of the great periods of prosperity in American history. Again, I'm not suggesting that it was because of that. Obviously, other things, the boom with computers and a variety of other things caused it, but at the very least, it did not prevent that from happening, and indeed resulted finally, or was part of what resulted by the end of the decade, in a couple of years of actually balanced budgets, which in the beginning of the 90s had seemed like something that was totally impossible. So there's also that contrary view, so that doing the opposite of the trickle-down economics has been shown to work, not just then, but at other times. Every time the trickle-down has been tried, it doesn't work, but again, they just keep saying, try it again, try it again.
Yeah. So you have this great track record with seeing other things coming. Here we are. What do you think? Is a collapse on the horizon? And if so, when do you think it might happen?
Well, I think that if the policies that are being followed now remain in effect and are carried even further by cutting back on the social safety net programs that help to keep buying power up when people are thrown out of work and so forth, a collapse is certain to happen. There are lots of things in the time in between when that might happen now and that time that could avert it. In particular, we might see a change in control of the government and a change in some of these policies, which might avert it entirely. As far as trying at this point to figure out exactly when something like that might happen, I think it's too soon to say. Again, it seems likely that a tax cut on such a massive scale, which is being financed by what Senator Benson referred to as writing hot checks, in this case almost entirely to those who already have much more money than they know what to do with, is going to stimulate the economy for a while, and so things may continue to improve in the short run, and that short run might even go on for a year or two. But at some point down the line, if those policies aren't changed, the piper is going to have to be paid.
Yes, and to our listeners, a little note from history. Most of the significant market crashes in American history have occurred in the fall, and September is the only month in the last 100 years or so in which, on average, the market has been down. So that's something to keep your eyes on. So finally, I just want to ask you this. We ask everybody this question. What led you to become a historian and then to begin studying the Great Depression?
Yes, I've been asked that quite a bit, particularly the whole idea of the Great Depression. I remember when I was trying to get my first book published, a collection of letters people wrote to the Roosevelts and others during the Depression. It was turned down by several publishers who said, the letters are just too depressing. And I said, well, you know, it is the Depression. But anyway, what attracts you to depression, people might be asking. Best I can reconstruct it, my mother, who never went to college but was an avid reader, was into history enormously, and she was always talking about history. I was adopted at a time when my parents were in their mid-40s, and so they had lived through the Depression, and they talked about it a great deal. And so the interest in history, I think, was stimulated largely by my mother, and then getting focusing in on the Great Depression, I imagine, although I wasn't thinking of it consciously, was at least partially a result of hearing their Depression stories growing up. By that time in the 1960s, I had moved towards favoring some sort of democratic socialism like the Scandinavian models or like Bernie Sanders now proposes. And I was kind of astonished when I found out that at the time of the absolute collapse of the capitalist economy in the United States, that Norman Thomas in 1932 had not gotten that much support. I don't remember just what it was now, but it was below 2%, maybe even lower than that. I don't remember. And so I kind of started out trying to figure out why it was that people were not attracted to an alternative, and it kind of went from there.
Wow, that's amazing. I miss my grandmother. She was born in 1921, and the stories that she would tell about growing up in the Depression, she was always one of those people who was stern, and but she lived through it, she grew up in it, and she would remind you not to take everything for granted.
Right, and that, you know, the being frugal in particular stayed with that generation, or the vast majority of them, through their whole lives. Not so much us.
Yeah, the baby boomers learned a different lesson, and so did my Gen Xers. Well, Dr. Robert McElveen, thank you so much for your time on The Road to Now. We look forward to maybe talking with you in the future, and thank you.
All right. Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, sir. The Road to Now was hosted by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. It's produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Today's music is by Paul DeFiglio. We'd like to say a special thanks, as always, to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout-out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, and Jeff LeCain. We'd also like to thank our newest Lincoln Tier member, Nicholas Greenfield. As always, we thank you for what you do on Patreon. Check us out, patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second, and it does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care.
Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.